Thus it was that when the stranger, the someone, did appear out of nowhere, Pauline was grateful but not surprised. He came, shredding right out of a Kentucky sun on the hottest day of the year. He came big. He came strong. He came with yellow eyes, flaring nostrils, and he came with his own music. Pauline was leaning idly on the fence, her arms resting on the crosswell between the pickets. She had just put down some biscuit dough and was cleaning the flour from under her nails. Behind her, at some distance, she heard whistling, one of these rapid high-note riffs that black boys make up as they go while sweeping, shoveling, or just walking along. A kind of city street music where laughter belies anxiety and joy is as short and straight as the blade of a pocket knife. She listened carefully to the music and let it pull her lips into a smile. The whistling got louder, and still she did not turn around, for she wanted it to last. While smiling to herself and holding fast to the break in somber thoughts, she felt something tickling her foot. She laughed aloud and turned to see. The whistler was bending down, tickling her broken foot and kissing her leg. She could not stop her laughter, not until he looked up at her and she saw the Kentucky sun drenching the yellow, heavy-lidded eyes of Charlie Breedlove. When I first see Charlie, I want you to know it was like all the bits of color from that time down home when all us children went berry picking after a funeral, and I put some in the pocket of my Sunday dress, and they mashed up and stained my hips. My whole dress was messed with purple, and it never did wash out. Not the dress, nor me. I could feel that purple deep inside me, and that lemonade Mama used to make when Pap came in out the fields. It'd be cool and yellowish, with seeds floating near the bottom. And that streak of green them June bugs made on the trees the night we left from down home. All of them colors was in me, just sitting there. So when Charlie come up and tickled my foot, it was like them berries, that lemonade, them streaks of green the June bugs made all come together. Charlie was thin then, with real light eyes. He used to whistle, and when I heard him, shivers come on my skin.
Pauline and Charlie loved each other. He seemed to relish her company and even to enjoy her country ways and lack of knowledge about city things. He talked with her about her foot and asked when they walked through the town or in the fields if she were tired. Instead of ignoring her infirmity, pretending it was not there, he made it seem like something special and endearing. For the first time, Pauline felt that her bad foot was an asset. And he did touch her, firmly but gently, just as she had dreamed. But minus the gloom of setting suns and lonely riverbanks, she was secure and grateful. He was kind and lively. She had not known there was so much laughter in the world. They agreed to marry and go way up north where Charlie said steel mills were begging for workers. Young, loving, and full of energy, they came to Lorain, Ohio. Charlie found work in the steel mills right away, and Pauline started keeping house. And then she lost her front tooth. But there must have been a speck, a brown speck easily mistaken for food, but which did not leave, which sat on the enamel for months and grew until it cut into the surface and then to the brown putty underneath, finally eating away to the root, but avoiding the nerves, so its presence was not noticeable or uncomfortable. Then the weakened roots, having grown accustomed to the poison, responded one day to severe pressure, and the tooth fell free, leaving a ragged stump behind. But even before the little brown speck, there must have been the conditions, the settings that would allow it to exist in the first place. In that young and growing Ohio town whose side streets, even, were paved with concrete, which sat on the edge of a calm blue lake, which boasted an affinity with Oberlin, the Underground Railroad station, just 13 miles away. This melting pot on the lip of America facing the cold but receptive Canada, what could go wrong?
Me and Charlie was getting on long good then. We come up north, supposed to be more jobs and all. We moved into two rooms up over a furniture store,
and I set about housekeeping. Charlie was working at the steel plant, and everything was looking good. I don't know what all happened. Everything changed. It was hard to get to know folks up here, and I missed my people. I weren't used to so much white folks. The ones I see before was something hateful, but they didn't come around too much. I mean, we didn't have too much truck with them. Just now and then in the fields or at the commissary. But they weren't all over us. Up north, they was everywhere. Next door, downstairs, all over the streets, and colored folks few and far between. Northern colored folks was different, too. Dicty-like. No better than whites for meanness. They could make you feel just as no count, except I didn't expect it from them. That was the lonesomest time of my life. I remember looking out them front windows just waiting for Charlie to come home at 3 o'clock. I didn't even have a cat to talk to. In her loneliness, she turned to her husband for reassurance, entertainment, for things to fill the vacant places. Housework was not enough. There were only 2 rooms and no yard to keep or move about in. The women in the town wore high-heeled shoes, and when Pauline tried to wear them, they aggravated her shuffle into a pronounced limp. Charlie was kindness still, but began to resist her total dependence on him. They were beginning to have less and less to say to each other. He had no problem finding other people and other things to occupy him. Men were always climbing the stairs asking for him, and he was happy to accompany them, leaving her alone. Pauline felt uncomfortable with the few black women she met. They were amused by her because she did not straighten her hair. When she tried to make up her face as they did, it came off rather badly. Their gouting glances and private snickers at her way of talking, saying children, and dressing and developed in her a desire for new clothes. When Charlie began to quarrel about the money she wanted, she decided to go to work. Taking jobs as a day worker helped with the clothes and even a few things for the apartment, but it did not help with Charlie. He was not pleased with her purchases and began to tell her so. Their marriage was shredded with quarrels. She was still no more than a girl and still waiting for that plateau of happiness, that hand of a precious lord who, when her way grew drear, would always linger near. Only now she had a clearer idea of what drear meant. Money became the focus of all their discussions, hers for clothes, his for drink. The sad thing was that Pauline did not really care for clothes and makeup. She merely wanted other women to cast favorable glances her way. After several months of doing day work, she took a steady job in the home of a family of slender means and nervous, pretentious ways. Charlie commenced to get meaner and meaner and wanted to fight me all the time. I give him as good as I got. Had to. Looked like working for that woman and fighting Charlie was all I did. Tiresome. But I hold on to my jobs, even though working for that woman was more than a notion. It wasn't so much her meanness as just simple-minded. Her whole family was. Couldn't get along with one another worth nothing. You'd think with a pretty house like that and all the money they could hold on to, they would enjoy one another. She'd haul off and cry over the leastest thing. If one of her friends cut her short on the telephone, she'd go to crying. She should have been glad she had a telephone. I ain't got one yet. I recollect once how her baby brother, who she put through dentistry school, didn't invite them to some big party he throwed. They was a big to-do about that. Everybody stayed on the telephone for days, fussing, carrying on. She asked me, Pauline, what would you do if your own brother had a party and didn't invite you? I said, if I really wanted to go to that party, I reckon I'd go anyhow. Never mind what he want. She just sucked her teeth a little and made out like what I said was dumb. All the while, I was thinking how dumb she was. Whoever told her that her brother was her friend?
Folks can't like folks just because they has the same mama. I tried to like that woman myself. She was good about giving me stuff, but I just couldn't like her. Soon as I worked up a good feeling on her account, she'd do something ignorant and start into telling me how to clean and do. If I left her on her own and she'd drown in dirt, I didn't have to pick up after chicken and pie the way I had to pick up after them. None of them knew so much as how to wipe their behinds. I know, because I did the washing and couldn't pee proper to save their lives. Her husband ain't hit the bowl yet. Nasty white folks is about the nastiest things they is. But I would have stayed on seven for Charlie come over by where I was working and cut up, so he come there drunk, wanting some money. When that white woman see him, she turned red. She tried to act strong like, but she was scared bad. Anyway, she told Charlie to get out or she would call the police. He cussed her and started pulling on me. I would have gone upside his head, but I didn't want no dealings with the police. So I taken my things and left. I tried to get back, but she didn't want me no more if I was going to stay with Charlie. She said she would let me stay if I left him. I thought about that. But later on, it didn't seem none too bright for a black woman to leave a black man for a white woman. She had never given me the $11 she owed me neither. That hurt bad. The gas man had cut the gas off, and I couldn't cook none. I really begged that woman for my money. I went to see her. She was mad as a wet hen, kept on telling me I owed her for uniforms and some old broken down bed she gave me. I didn't know if I owed her or not, but I needed my money. She wouldn't let up none neither, even when I give her my word that Charlie wouldn't come back there no more. Then I got so desperate, I asked her if she would loan it to me. She was quiet for a spell, and then she told me I shouldn't let a man take advantage over me, that I should have more respect. And it was my husband's duty to pay the bills, and if he couldn't, I should leave and get alimony. All such simple stuff. What was he going to give me alimony on? I seen she didn't understand that all I needed from her was my $11 to pay the gas man so I could cook. She couldn't get that one thing through her thick head. Are you going to leave him, Pauline? She kept on saying. I thought she'd give me my money if I said I would, so I said, yes, ma'am. All right, she said. You leave him and then come back to work and we'll let bygones be bygones. Can I have my money today? I said. No, she said. Only when you leave him. I'm only thinking of you and your future. What good is he, Pauline? What good is he to you? How you gonna answer a woman like that? Who don't know what a good man is and say out of one side of her mouth she's thinking of your future but won't give you your own money so you can buy you something besides bologna to eat. So I said, no good, ma'am. He ain't no good to me. But just the same, I think I best stay on. She got up and left. When I got outside, I felt pains in my crotch. I'd held my legs together so tight trying to make that woman understand. But I reckon now she couldn't understand. She married a man with a slash in his face instead of a mouth. So how could she understand? One winter, Pauline discovered she was pregnant. When she told Charlie, he surprised her by being pleased. He began to drink less and come home more often. They eased back into a relationship more like the early days of their marriage, when he asked if she were tired or wanted him to bring her something from the store. In this state of ease, Pauline stopped doing day work and returned to her own housekeeping. But the loneliness in those two rooms had not gone away. When the winter sun hit the peeling green paint of the kitchen chairs, when the smoked hocks were boiling in the pot, when all she could hear was the truck delivering furniture downstairs, she thought about back home, about how she had been all alone most of the time then too, but that this lonesomeness was different. Then she stopped staring at the green chairs. At the delivery truck, she went to the movies instead. There in the dark of her memory was refreshed, and she succumbed to her earlier dreams. Along with the idea of romantic love, she was introduced to another. Physical beauty. Probably the most destructive of ideas in the history of human thought. Both originated in envy,
thrived in insecurity, and ended in disillusion. In equating physical beauty with virtue, she stripped her mind, bound it, and collected self-contempt by the heap. She forgot lust and simple caring for. She regarded love as possessive mating and romance as the goal of the spirit. It would be for her a wellspring from which she would draw the most destructive emotions, deceiving the lover and seeking to imprison the beloved, curtailing freedom in every way. She was never able, after her education in the movies, to look at a face and not assign it some category in the scale of absolute beauty, and the scale was one she absorbed in full from the silver screen. There at last were the darkened woods, the lonely roads, the river banks, the gentle knowing eyes. There the flawed became whole, the blind sighted, and the lame and halt threw away their crutches. There death was dead, and people made every gesture in a cloud of music. There the black and white images came together, making a magnificent whole, all projected through the ray of light from above and beyond, behind. It was really a simple pleasure, but she learned all there was to love and all there was to hate. The onlyest time I'd be happy seemed like when I was in the picture show. Every time I got, I went. I'd go early, before the show started. They'd cut off the lights and everything be black. Then the screen would light up and everything, and I'd move right on in them pictures. White men taking such good care of they women, and they all dressed up in big clean houses with bathtubs right in the same room with the toilet. Them pictures gave me a lot of pleasure. But it made coming home hard and looking at Charlie hard. I don't know. I remember one time I went to see Clark Gable and Jean Harlow. I fixed my hair up like I'd seen hers on a magazine. I part on the side with one little curl on my forehead. It looked just like her. Well, almost just like. Anyway, I sat in that show with my hair done up that way and had a good time. I thought I'd see it through to the end again, and I got up to get me some candy. I was sitting back in my seat, and I'd taken a big bite of that candy, and it pulled a tooth right out of my mouth. I could have cried. I had good teeth, not a rotten one in my head. I don't believe I ever did get over that. There I was, 5 months pregnant, trying to look like Jean Harlow and a front tooth gone. Everything went then. Looked like I just didn't care no more after that. I let my hair go back, plaited it up, and settled down to just being ugly. I still went to the pictures, though, but the meanness got worse. I wanted my tooth back. Charlie poked fun at me, and we started fighting again. I tried to kill him. He didn't hit me too hard, because I were pregnant, I guess, but the fights, once they started up again, kept up. He began to make me madder than anything I knowed, and I couldn't keep my hands off him. Well, I had that baby, a boy, and after that got pregnant again with another one. But it weren't like I thought it was going to be. I loved them and all, I guess, but maybe it was having no money, or maybe it was Charlie, but they sure worried the life out of me. Sometimes I'd catch myself hollering at them and beating them, and I'd feel sorry for them, but I couldn't seem to stop. When I had the second one, a girl, I remember I said I'd love it no matter what it looked like. She looked like a black ball of hair. I don't recollect trying to get pregnant that first time, but that second time, I actually tried to get pregnant. Maybe because I had one already and wasn't scared to do it. Anyway, I felt good and was thinking on the carrying, just the baby itself. I used to talk to it while being still in the womb. Like good friends we was, you know. I'd be hanging wash and node lifting weren't good for it. I'd say to it, hold on now. I'm going to hang up these few rags. Don't get froggy. It'd be over soon. It wouldn't leap or nothing. Or I'd be mixing something in a bowl for the other child and I'd talk to it then too. You know, just friendly talk. On up to the end, I felt good about that baby. I went to the hospital when my time come so I could be easeful. I didn't want to have it at home like I done with the boy. They put me in a big room with a whole mess of women. The pains was coming, but not too bad. A little old doctor come to examine me. He had all sorts of stuff.
He gloved his hand and put some kind of jelly on it and rammed it up between my legs. When he left off, some more doctors come, one old one and some young ones. The old one was learning the young ones about babies, showing them how to do. When he got to me, he said, "Now these here women you don't have any trouble with. They deliver right away and with no pain, just like horses." The young ones smiled a little. They looked at my stomach and between my legs. They never said nothing to me. Only one looked at me. Looked at my face, I mean. I looked right back at him. He dropped his eyes and turned red. He knowed, I reckon, that maybe I weren't no horse fouling. But them others, they didn't know. They went on. I see them talking to that white woman. "How you feel? Gonna have twins?" Just shucking them, of course, but nice talk. Nice friendly talk. I got edgy, and when them pains got harder, I was glad. Glad to have something else to think about. I moaned something awful. The pains wasn't as bad as I let on, but I had to let them people know having a baby was more than a bowel movement. I hurt just like them white women. Just because I wasn't hooping and hollering before didn't mean I wasn't feeling pain. What'd they think? That just because I knowed how to have a baby with no fuss that my behind wasn't pulling and aching like theirs? Besides, that doctor don't know what he talking about. He must never see no mare fowl. Who say they don't have no pain? Just because she don't cry? Because she can't say it? They think it ain't there? If they looks in her eyes and see them eyeballs lolling back, see the sorrowful look, they know. Anyways, the baby come. Big old healthy thing. She looked different from what I thought. Reckon I talked to it so much before I conjured up a mind's eye view of it. So when I seed it, it was like looking at a picture of your mama when she was a girl. He knows who she is, but she just don't look the same. They give it to me for a nursing, and she liked to pull my nipple off right away. She caught on fast. Not like Sammy. He was the hardest child to feed. But Pecola looked like she knew right off what to do. A right smart baby she was. I used to like to watch her. You know they makes them greedy sounds. Eyes all soft and wet. A cross between a puppy and a dying man. But I know she was ugly. Head full of pretty hair, but Lord, was she ugly. When Sammy and Pecola were still young, Pauline had to go back to work. She was older now, with no time for dreams and movies. It was time to put all the pieces together, make coherence where before there had been none. The children gave her this need. She herself was no longer a child, so she became. And her process of becoming was like most of ours. She developed a hatred for things that mystified or obstructed her, acquired virtues that were easy to maintain, assigned herself a role in the scheme of things, and harked back to simpler times for gratification. She took on the full responsibility and recognition of breadwinner and returned to church. First, however, she moved out of the two rooms into a spacious first floor of a building that had been built as a store. She came into her own with the women who had despised her by being more moral than they. She avenged herself on Charlie by forcing him to indulge in the weakness she despised. She joined a church where shouting was frowned upon, served on stewardess board number 3, and became a member of ladies' circle number 1. At prayer meetings, she moaned and sighed over Charlie's ways and hoped God would help her keep the children from the sins of the father. She stopped saying children and said children instead. She let another tooth fall and was outraged by painting ladies who thought only of clothes and men. Holding Charlie as a model of sin and failure, she bore him like a crown of thorns and her children like a cross. It was her good fortune to find a permanent job in the home of a well-to-do family whose members were affectionate, appreciative, and generous. She looked at their houses, smelled their linen, touched their silk draperies, and loved all of it. The child's pink nightie, the stacks of white pillow slips edged with embroidery, the sheets with top hems picked out with blue cornflowers. She became what is known as an ideal servant, for such a role filled practically all of her needs. When she bathed the little fisher girl, it was in a porcelain tub with silvery taps running infinite quantities of hot, clear water. She dried her in fluffy white towels and put her in cuddly nightclothes. Then she brushed the yellow hair, enjoying the roll and slip of it between her fingers. No zinc tub, no buckets of stove-heated water, no flaky, stiff, grayish towels washed in a kitchen sink.
dried in a dusty backyard, no tangled black puffs of rough wool to comb. Soon she stopped trying to keep her own house. The things she could afford to buy did not last, had no beauty or style, and were absorbed by the dingy storefront. More and more she neglected her house, her children, her man. They were like the afterthoughts one has just before sleep, the early morning and late evening edges of her day, the dark edges that made the daily life with the Fishers lighter, more delicate, more lovely. Here she could arrange things, clean things, line things up in neat rows. Here her foot flopped around on deep pile carpets, and there was no uneven sound. Here she found beauty, order, cleanliness, and praise. Mr. Fisher said, "I would rather sell her blueberry cobblers than real estate." She reigned over cupboards stacked high with food that would not be eaten for weeks, even months. She was queen of canned vegetables bought by the case. Special fondants and ribbon candy curled up in tiny silver dishes. The creditors and service people who humiliated her when she went to them on her own behalf respected her, were even intimidated by her when she spoke for the Fishers. She refused beef slightly dark or with edges not properly trimmed. The slightly reeking fish that she accepted for her own family she would all but throw in the fishman's face if he sent it to the Fisher house. Power, praise, and luxury were hers in this household. They even gave her what she had never had, a nickname, Polly. It was her pleasure to stand in her kitchen at the end of a day and survey her handiwork, knowing there were soap bars by the dozen, bacon by the rasher, and reveling in her shiny pots and pans and polished floors, hearing, "We'll never let her go. We could never find anybody like Polly. She will not leave this kitchen until everything is in order. Really, she is the ideal servant." Pauline kept this order, this beauty for herself, a private world, and never introduced it into her storefront or to her children. Them she bent toward respectability and in so doing taught them fear. Fear of being clumsy, fear of being like their father, fear of not being loved by God, fear of madness like Charlie's mother's. Into her son she beat a loud desire to run away, and into her daughter she beat a fear of growing up. Fear of the other people, fear of life. All the meaningfulness of her life was in her work, for her virtues were intact. She was an active churchwoman, did not drink, smoke, or carouse, defending herself mightily against Charlie, rose above him in every way, and felt she was fulfilling a mother's role conscientiously when she pointed out their father's faults to keep them from having them, or punish them when they showed any slovenliness. No matter how slight, when she worked 12 to 16 hours a day to support them, and the world itself agreed with her. It was only sometimes, and then rarely, that she thought about the old days, or what her life had turned to. They were musings, idle thoughts, full sometimes, of the old dreaminess, but not the kind of thing she cared to dwell on. I started to leave him once, but something came up. Once after he tried to set the house on fire, I was all set in my mind to go. I can't even remember now what held me. He sure didn't give me much of a life. But it wasn't all bad. Sometimes things wasn't all bad. He used to come easing into bed sometimes, not too drunk. I make out like I'm asleep, cause it's late, and he taking $3 out of my pocketbook that morning or something. I hear him breathing, but I don't look around. I can see in my mind's eye his black arms thrown back behind his head, the muscles like great big peach stones sanded down, with veins running like little swollen rivers down his arms. Without touching him, I'd be feeling those ridges on the tips of my fingers. I seize the palms of his hands calloused to granite and the long fingers curled up still. I think about the thick, knotty hair on his chest and the two big swells his breast muscles make. I want to rub my face hard in his chest and feel the hair cut my skin. I know just where the hair growth slacks out, just above his navel, and how it picks up again and spreads out. Maybe he'll shift a little and his leg will touch me, or I feel his flank just graze my behind. I don't move even yet. Then he lifts his head, turn over, and put his hand on my waist. If I don't move, he'll move his hand over to pull and knead my stomach, soft and slow-like. I still don't move, because I don't want him to stop. I want to pretend sleep and have him keep on rubbing my stomach. Then he will lean his head down and bite my tit. Sorry.